This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
it is the 36th time in 3 years that the French authorities have had to clear out migrant camps in Paris. So they clearly are really fumbling as to how to deal with this migrant influx.
That's Catherine Field describing for VOA today's operations by Paris police to clear out migrant camps. Details coming up.
Also, the Ethiopian government aims to lift the country's state of emergency, and foreign ministers of the BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, are meeting in Pretoria today.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Ethiopia's cabinet and parliament are aiming to lift the country's state of emergency that was imposed in February after months of widespread anti-government protests. According to the Associated Press, this would be the most significant change so far under the country's young new prime minister, who has spoken openly about the need for reforms. To shed light on the matter, we have in studio VOA's Horn of Africa reporter Salomon Abate. Welcome, Salomon, to Africa News Tonight.
Thank you, Yehis, for inviting me to your show.
So bring us up to date on Ethiopia's state of emergency. Is it about to be lifted or is it lifted already?
Well, this state of emergency has been in place for about 80 days, and the Council of Ministers approved the draft bill to lift the state of emergency the day before yesterday, on Saturday, that is the 2nd of this month, June. And it is planned to be brought to the Parliament's floor tomorrow. Okay. And as soon as the Parliament approves the bill, it will be lifted immediately.
So, like, we can say by tomorrow the state of emergency in Ethiopia will be lifted.
We expect that.
So what was like when the state of emergency was in effect, as opposed to Ethiopians, like, let's say, tomorrow? What will look different tomorrow after the state of emergency is removed?
Under the state of emergency, meetings, gatherings, public gatherings were prohibited, and different engagements, you know, public engagements were banned. So tomorrow, if it will be lifted by the parliament, the constitutional order will be back. The military was in charge of the country during this 2 months and something. So everything will be back in place to normal.
So does the new prime minister have anything to do with this?
The prime minister is at the front, he's spearheading, in fact, the whole change, the whole movement currently. And he spoke, he appeared on national TV on Saturday, and he said relative peace and order has been restored in the country, and it has a lot to do for the peaceful existence of the country. So he released thousands of prisoners who had been incarcerated, you know, during the last 2 years and even more than 2 years, and even prisoners in death row who were leaders of opposition parties, some bitter opposition parties, were released even last week. And one of them was Andargacho Tsege, the leader of Gumboots 7. So this prime minister has been calling for unity, for calm, and to work together for the better future. And, of course, this prime minister has a lot to do with it.
So the party he belongs to, mm-hmm. that's the EPRDF, are they in the same wavelength as he is? Or is this a maverick by himself?
Well, this is a question that a lot of analysts and activists are raising these days. And the lifting of the state of emergency was at the helm of all demands, at the top of all demands. And there are other laws to be abolished, like the CS, civic society law, like the terror law, like the media guidelines or regulations. So people are asking now, is this a new prime minister of an old party, the party which even didn't change its program yet? Mm-hmm. It didn't even its name. It didn't change. It remains Revolutionary Democratic Front. And there are some skeptic people that say there is some kind of resistance within the party that deters the new prime minister from going ahead fast. In other ways, he is enjoying a big support within his own party. That's why, you know, he has this power, you know, to do changes, to release the prisoners, to apologize even in the name of the on behalf of the party, and he is enjoying a big support among Ethiopians. A recent survey report indicated that about 84% of Ethiopians support the new prime minister. About 88% expressed that he would bring about changes, positive changes to the country. So there is some kind of mild resistance. But for the most part of it, he has a big support within his party and outside the party as well.
New chapter unfolding in Ethiopia. Salomon Abata from VOA's Horn of Africa service, thank you for the update.
Thank you.
Authorities in Paris today cleared two more migrant camps in the city, taking about 1,000 migrants to temporary shelters. Last week, authorities rounded up about 1,000 migrants at other camps and have checked their documents to start the process of determining who can remain in the country while their asylum requests are processed. More than half of that group was from Sudan, while about 25% came from Eritrea, Somalia, or Chad. Reporter Catherine Field in Paris has been following the city's effort to clear the migrant camps. She spoke with our colleague Kate Pound Dawson about the latest push to rehouse the migrants.
These are two camps, one alongside a canal and one slightly further north of the center of Paris in an area called Port de la Chapelle, which has been a magnet for migrants to that area for the last 3 or 4 years. In all, authorities took in some 970 migrants. It was an operation that was done first thing in the morning. They went in, of course, with security. They went in with buses and just truckloads of police to make sure that this operation went off smoothly. And indeed, it did. They've now taken all these migrants to some 16 emergency shelters around the capital. And if last week's evacuation is anything to go by, the promise that these migrants will have their papers checked quite quickly seems to be bearing fruit. They say that by the end of this week, all this group of migrants will have had their papers checked and the authorities will be able to decide where they go next.
How many of the migrants are expected to be able to stay?
It really depends on what they've done. For example, if we take the figures from last week, Wednesday of last week, when authorities brought in some 1,000 migrants, only around 25% of them still hadn't applied for asylum or refugee status. So you're looking at that 25% will be able to stay. Also from that group, quite a lot had already applied for refugee or asylum status somewhere else in Europe. And police say this could be the same with this group today, that at least 50% of them have applied for a refugee or asylum status somewhere else in Europe. Now, what that means is
they are going to have to go back there, whether it be Germany, Italy, Sweden, Denmark, they will have to go back there. What we're also seeing is around 10%, and they say it could be the same with this group today, around 10% have already applied for refugee or asylum status. It's been accepted, but the city of Paris has nowhere to house them. So they've been in this vicious circle of having arrived in France, having had their application accepted and in some cases approved, but they just do not have the funds, or the state does not have the facilities to be able to house them. So they've ended up back sleeping rough.
The housing problem you've mentioned, how serious is that in addressing the long-term migrant situation?
It doesn't address it at all. This, let's be honest here. It is the 36th time in 3 years that the French authorities have had to clear out migrant camps in Paris. So they clearly are really fumbling as to how to deal with this migrant influx. So it's not going to deal with it at all. It's just going to keep coming. The authorities are keeping a much closer eye on that border area between Italy and France, where a lot of migrants are still walking across from Italy. This really is not going to change it. What they are hoping, though, the French in particular, is that the European Union will be doing more on the ground in certain African countries, particularly Sudan, Eritrea, Chad, Somalia, to recognize refugee or asylum status there so that these people can be processed either there or in, for example, Mali, and then flown to France or flown to Italy, where facilities will have already been set up for them.
That was Catherine Field in Paris speaking with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson.
Just over 6 months after being sworn in as president of Angola, João Lourenço governs an economy in shambles. But addressing urgent economic woes may rattle the country's fragile social stability and will require political skill. VOA's Luis Costa Ribas looks at those challenges in the special report for VOA.
4 years ago, oil accounted for over 60% of Angola's gross domestic product. But as crude prices fell, the GDP dropped steeply, inflation soared, real income shrunk, and poverty rose. It didn't have to be that way, says José Alves de Rocha, head of the Center for Studies and Scientific Research at the Catholic University of Angola. He says the 2009 oil crisis provided a warning that the economy needed to be less oil dependent. The previous government had plans to achieve that, but never acted on them.
Na prática, nada foi feito. Porque, entretanto, o preço do barril do petróleo subiu, voltou a proporcionar à economia.
Russia says there were many plans, but nothing was done to reform the economy because the oil prices recovered, providing the government with higher fiscal revenue and foreign currency. The plans entailed revitalizing the agriculture sector, growing the non-oil economy, and reforming the government. Now, Angola faces stunted economic growth and runaway deficits. This year, spending to cover the debt is expected to reach 31% of the GDP, almost five times the budget for health and education. Carlos Rosado Carvalho, an economics professor and editor-in-chief of Expansão, Angolan's main business newspaper, thinks the recent rise in oil prices has helped stabilize the situation. Now, he says, President Lourenço's challenge is macroeconomic stabilization, managing currency reserves, promoting growth, and lowering inflation.
Para tal existe programa. Esse programa é programa, do meu ponto de vista, é bom programa.
Carvalho says there's a plan for that, and in his view, it's a good plan. He says it would not have been much different if it were drafted by the International Monetary Fund. But now the challenge is to implement the plan. He says the president needs more power to carry out the plan. Carvalho says the problem is the ruling party, known as MPLA. Many party elites have grown rich, he says, and things will not change if the party blocks reforms, such as currency devaluation.
É necessário conferir maior transparência na sociedade, nos negócios angolanos.
He says the country needs greater transparency to grow the private sector, and that has faced obstacles within the MPLA, as has the fight against corruption. Carvalho says there's been no political will to address economic diversification because that would run counter to powerful interests. Rocha warns that agricultural growth is down, manufacturing has contracted, and construction is in trouble. What's more, Angola imports just about everything and depends heavily on foreign currency to pay external suppliers. But with currency reserves falling, Rocha says there's growing risk of company bankruptcies and an economic contraction. He says the high unemployment rate and falling living standards show this is already happening. Rocha expects a decline in private as well as state consumption as the foreign currency shortage causes supplies to drop and prices to rise.
Portanto, nós próprios, as famílias angolanas, vão ter que fazer ajustamento a curto prazo em baixo.
He says Angolan families will have to adjust below current levels with less ability to meet their needs. The state will have to do that too. It will have to adjust its public consumption because it has no resources to do it in a different way. Former President José Eduardo dos Santos often took credit for leading Angola's ravaged economy to double-digit growth rates after the end of decades of civil war, but his critics say a few got rich and most Angolans are poor. Carvalho and Rocha warn that rising poverty could lead to unrest in a country where 60% of the nearly 30 million people live on less than $2 a day. The ruling MPLA party is preparing to name President Lourenço as its new leader, ending a rift with former President dos Santos. Once that happens, they say, Lourenço will have no grace period when it comes to reviving the economy. Luis Costa Rivas, VOA, Boston.
Top diplomats of the largest emerging economies are expected to discuss security concerns, world trade, and multinational approaches to transnational issues when they meet today in Pretoria. The foreign ministers of the BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, will be finalizing details of a gathering of their heads of government next month. South African International Relations Minister Lindiwe Sisulu said at the opening of the meeting that multilateral cooperation is under threat. She said the BRICS nations should assert their responsibility to advancing multilateral solutions to the world's problems. The BRICS nations make up about 40% of the world's population, and they are some of the fastest growing economies.
Nigerian police have asked the Senate president to come in for questioning over a series of bank robberies that left 30 people dead, including 9 police officers. Police say 22 people have been arrested in the investigation of 6 robberies on April 5th. Police say 5 of the ringleaders have confessed and claim Senate President Bukalo Saraki and the governor of Kwara State provided guns, money and vehicles for the deadly crime spree. Both Saraki and the governor Alhaji Abdul Fattah Ahmad have called the allegations baseless.
Healthcare workers have identified 7 new suspected Ebola patients in the DRC. The World Health Organization says that brings the new total of confirmed or suspected cases to 57 with 25 deaths. The WHO says all 7 of the new suspected cases were known contacts of earlier patients. Doctors Without Borders, known as MSF, has been helping lead efforts to contain this outbreak. Dr. Hilda Duclerc, one of the aid group's leading Ebola experts, says getting community support is important in halting the spread of the disease. She spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson from Brussels, where she is part of the command center team for MSF's response.
So people who are only in contact with a patient, who might be infected but who don't show symptoms yet, they are no risk to others. So actually we encourage people to keep their social life. It's important. So it's important not to quarantine them or something too early on. It's not needed. But of course, once someone is sick, we fully agree, then we discourage direct physical contact. But the only way you can do this is that you still guarantee that they have the support from their families, that they can still have family visits, they can still see people, talk to people. And it's only the true physical contact that you should try to limit or to block. So for example, how do we do this in the centers? It is that indeed people are isolated, But we always say an isolation is not a prison. You need to have patient terraces, you need to have windows, and people can talk over the window, over the terrace, to their family members, to their neighbors. And in that sense, we're lucky. Ebola is not airborne. So we can use this little distance as sufficient distance to play it safe, but to still encourage social contact. And another good example is that, indeed, the burials are very often very very dangerous. But again, you cannot destroy like the full traditions of a burial. So the trick is to really find compromises with the families themselves, with the communities, and say, like, look, maybe direct washing and touching of the body may not be possible because that's very often the tradition. But either we take someone of your family and we give them protective gear, and we can still do like a limited type of washing. Sometimes this was done in the past. Or you say, like, look, you can do at least your prayers and you can be around. This takes more time, and that's, I think, also very tough for the intervening teams. It is a hyper-emergency, so I think everyone has a little bit the idea that we should go rapid. But you cannot destroy, like, all traditions because, yeah, people will not trust you, and that's very obvious, and they will refuse to participate or to accept our advices.
Now, I want to go back to something you said a moment ago where you were comparing it to the 2014-2016 West Africa outbreak. And I wanted to see what is different, or if anything is different, between this outbreak and that devastating one in 2014.
Let's say the question is actually what happened in 2014, because that was actually the exception, I would say. All the outbreaks before remained smaller. The biggest ones were around 400 cases, and so that's more what you would expect. We don't have a full answer. There have been analyses, including by ourselves, that suggest that it was mainly really a non-isolation of cases. Why, it's difficult to tell. I'm not an anthropologist, but I know from many colleagues that they said that not every person, but that certain people in certain communities were really reluctant to receive help. And it was probably historical. People said, like, mistrust to central governance and so on. And the other factor that we're pretty sure of, but it's difficult to prove, is what I just mentioned. It was that in 2014, people moved really very far away. The very first week on, we already had cases in Conakry, which was at 600-700 kilometers of the epicenter, which was enormous. And this was quite of new. Even if in Uganda, in some of the Uganda outbreaks, we saw similar things, but only like with one case. Where in West Africa, it seemed to be more normal for people to seek healthcare really far away. Again, in Congo, at least as long as it's rural, you don't expect this. People will probably seek healthcare in the village next door, and that's it.
That was Dr. Hilda Duclerc with Doctors Without Borders. She was speaking with Kate Pound Dawson.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis, We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.